Good morning and happy Wednesday, everybody. We're all trying to acclimate to daylight savings. Isn't it awesome? Let's see here. The committee will come to order. And we do have a quorum. So let's see here. Representative Kreisha, do I have a motion to...
I'll move the minutes.
Thank you. Are there any additions, corrections, changes? All right. Hearing none, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same side. All right. Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. So we do have a packed agenda today. So I'm going to ask you to be brief in your presentations and questions. And the first bill up on the agenda today is House File 3629. Representative Bliss, if you want to come on down. You're next on the Child Care Committee. So I'm going to move that House File 3629 be approved and recommended to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. Fire up, Representative Bliss. It's 8:20 in the morning.
Good morning, and I have heard that there is a daylight savings bill making its way around.
I do have a bill. It hasn't gotten a hearing yet. If you could give a brief description of your bill.
Sure. HF 3629 seeks to cap the amount that daycare providers are charged for background fees on their employees at $160 per provider and $40 per background check. And, we're having a hard time finding daycare providers. There is a shortage, so we feel that this will help alleviate that.
All right. Do you have anyone in the audience that wishes to testify?
Here she comes.
Oh, one of my favorites is coming on up. Good morning.
And by the way, I am a freshman appearing in front of your committee for the first time, so I do have treats.
Yay!
Oh.
There's plenty.
I think you might be the only representative that has done that.
Yeah, you're
really?
Winning.
Yeah,
never,
you
never
are
mind.
Winning. All right. Well.
These are marked down representatives.
They're week old. Hope you got good teeth.
Good morning, Cindy. Lovely to see you this year. If you want to
good
state
morning.
Your name for the record, you know the drill.
I'll try to remember it. Cindy Cunningham, I'm a child care provider in St. Paul, Minnesota of 20 years. I'm also a board member for the new association, MCPIN, MCCPIN, MLFCCA shutdown, and a group of providers resurrected a full new association. So it's not a name that you might be familiar with at this time. It is a statewide full association. I didn't know this one was first, so catch up. I am in support of this bill, which places the cap. MCPIN had put forth in our public a policy that their agenda that there either be a type of a cap or a type of a payment plan or something along that line that would provide providers the ability to come up with the money to be responsible with their background checks, make sure everyone who needs to have a background check is affordably done while in our care. Currently on law, we have a cap of $100 essentially every 2 years to bump this up to the full amount, I'm not a mathematician, I take care of children, but I will read my piece. With a proposed state licensing fee of $40, I personally would be paying for a minimum of 6 background checks because I have children and emergency subs. That would be a total of $240. And I might not be, the numbers have been thrown around, but there is actually also a point of sale at the point where the fingerprints are taken, which is paid directly to the, say, the UPS or the place where you get the provider, where you actually get the fingerprints checked. I've heard approximately $15 for that. It would be in addition to the state background check. That would be approximately a total of $330 versus the $100 that I have to take care of. I might be able to handle that, but there are many providers in low income or lower served areas that might not be able to come up with that. The problem with that is I have to pay that money and have that all in place and my background checks done before I can get my license. My fear and concern is that a provider will reapply for their license, not be able to make that payment, and then will not be able to get their license approved and move forward. It's also a tripling of our fees at minimum from a first blush on it. So I would support this. McKinn supports this and would like to see something like this put forward, and this would fit our agenda.
Okay. Thank you, Cindy. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify? No? All right. Representative Bliss, do you have any final comments this Wednesday morning?
I'd appreciate your support.
Oh, sorry. We need to have discussion. Members, do we have discussion on the bill? No? Okay, seeing none. No final final comments?
No.
Okay, awesome. Well, then, I want to thank you for bringing forward House File 3629. Representative Bliss renews his motion that House File 3629 be approved and recommended to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And House File 3629 is approved and recommended to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. Next up, we have the amazing Vice Chair, Roz Peterson, with her House File 3403. And Representative Peterson moves House File 3403 be approved and recommended to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. And I understand that there is an A1 amendment.
Yes,
it's
Madam
an
Chair.
Author's amendment. All right. And Representative Peterson moves the A1 amendment. And if you want to please give a brief discussion of that amendment, that'd be awesome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The amendment deletes Section 1, which is the ratio portion of the bill, as well as add some language about the swaddling system, that you cannot have a hood or any other attachments, and then just add, define section 256.016 after, so it's just technical in nature that defines on page 4. So,
okay. And now if you want to, we got to have a discussion. Discussion, anyone, on the amendment? No? All right. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All right. Opposed, same sign. Mm-hmm. Motion prevails, and the A1 amendment is adopted. To your bill, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, as we've been sitting through these committees, listening to providers talk about some of the challenges that they're seeing and some of the reasons that I've seen that have hindered people from either staying in the profession or coming into the profession, we thought we'd take a hard look at some of the regulations that seem to be more onerous than helpful. And so this is what this bill really tries to address. So first of all, the risk of sudden unexpected infant death in licensed programs. So this is the clarification on the sleep systems, and we allow providers to use any sleep system that is not under recall or warning from the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission. And it's already in statute that a sleep system cannot restrict the hips or legs. So we also asked DHS to put some photos on their website for guidance and also what use of swaddle is prohibited. So that clarifies that for providers and the public.
Representative Peterson?
Yes.
So in your amendment, if I recall, you will be having the commissioner provide photographs, correct?
Correct.
You want to explain that a little bit?
Sure. Well, way it reads in the amendment, and so I'll just say what it says. The Commissioner of Human Services shall provide photographs of permitted sleep systems and their components parts on the Department of Human Services website. So, and that really is to help define what they're looking for, I think, and just giving a little bit better direction. And as a visual learner, I can certainly appreciate photos.
Absolutely, me too. All right, carry on.
Thank you. And then, secondly, is in regards to the child care license holder insurance.
And this removes the requirement that provider needs to give written notice if the policy is renewed. And so the thought being that parents don't necessarily need to see that you renewed your insurance because they're assuming that if you have insurance that it's stayed to be insured. And so it just seems to be a little redundant. And then under investigations, if there's an allegation of maltreatment, DHS must provide reasoning with specificity in clear and plain language. And so it adds that cross-reference language to the clear and plain language and sort of defines that in an easier way. And more or less, Madam Chair, that is the gist of the bill. And I know that we have some testifiers as well.
Okay. First up, I'd like to call down Cindy Cunningham. You're up in an episode of Today's Testifiers.
Yeah, I'll be done. Madam Chair, committee members, I am Cindy Cunningham. I am a provider in St. Paul for 20 years. I'm the board member of McKen. I also had the unique privilege in 2013 to be a primary testifier and representative for MLFCCA during the Safe Sleep changes. I was privileged to work closely with Jerry Kerber at the time, and we believe that we received and good support with DHS in cooperation that brought forth bills that were helpful to providers. The swaddle sack was kind of my baby, literally. I showed up at hearings with swaddle sacks and tried to educate people about what this was because at the time the push was for absolutely no swaddling of any kind, and that removes a useful tool from providers' hands in trying to take care of children, in particular when parents are continuously holding children, infants, and swaddling at home. When we get them, then our ability to calm and soothe the child is greatly limited without a potential of a tool. Excuse me. In no way at that time or at this time is any changes or use of a swaddle sack a requirement at all. Many providers do not want to use it. Many parents don't want to use it. They have the absolute right and choice to not use any system of any kind. In McPinn, we put forth public policy to modify this wording, and I will say that I don't like the wording that we put forth. So I'm in agreement of changing of the wording. For background on why we wanted to bring this forth is in 2013, there were a very limited number of products on the market that were even available to be used. At that point in time, it was very simple to identify what was a safe type of a product because that was only virtually one style. I called multiple times to the National SIDS Foundation. I've researched through the AAP to try to make sure that we're making safe, consistent requirements and products for children in our care. Neither one of them make a recommendation of any kind of sack. There is the mandate, which is a child on their back with nothing else in the crib other than a pacifier. Excuse me, I have not talked enough yet this morning. The challenge has become that as I've talked to providers, and providers know that I've been involved with the swaddle sack, what has happened is with the influx of multiple products, both for swaddling and for just infant sleep, there's become confusion and inconsistency between the counties. In some counties, if you say, may I use this product, a county licensor may say yes. Another county will say no. And if a licensor, there's one product on the market that when it was brought to DHS, DHS said, no, it can't be used. And yet I and only that individual, as far as I know that that's the ruling and that's the decision, meaning everybody else in 86 counties and every other provider does not know that if there was an incident, safe sleep incident with a child, and they had that product on them, they would be very liable for the use of that product, a minimum of a $200 fine. And if it was a SIDS situation, it would be another condemnation of them for a safe sleep practice. So essentially, we're out being sitting ducks with inconsistency. So what I'm looking for from the inception and for now is a type of a language that will direct DHS and the counties and clear communication to providers so we know what we can and can't use on our children. I've suggested additional wording, having known that there was an amendment in. I apologize for that. But this is also additional language. I think a warning from the CPSC, they have a, the website we have to go through for CRIBS anyway. And so that is a place we can go to. In my testimony, there is an example of one swallow sack that is on a recall. And so it is there. We're used to going to the website. The hood is a problem. Attachments are a problem. I provided the visuals in the testimony so you can see some of the examples. There's one example of a swaddle sack that is out there that actually would meet the current language. It has the wings across the shoulders, but it has a hood, which would not be at all recommended. So those would be examples of the inconsistency in products that there. As the McPinn representative, I apologize for the initial language being a little bit too blunt and short without the encompassing wording that would ultimately be helpful. I do agree with some kind of a visual posting, or at minimum when there is a determination made by DHS that a particular product should not be used, that gets disseminated to all providers so there's no question of what products they can use. There's also the complication that there are more products on the market, for non-swaddling sleeping. And there's been a determination on one such product that it can't be used, and yet it's not for swaddling. It's, again, providers don't know that DHS has stated that it can't be used. It's not for swaddling. It meets the CPSC requirements. It meets the flame retardant. It's a product that's out on the market. And if used appropriately per how the manufacturer intends it to be used, I would advocate for that we should be able to use it. Parents bring kids in sleepers. Parents bring kids. We put them down in sweatsuits. There's all kinds of things that children sleep in. If it's on the market, if it meets the manufacturer directions, and if it is not on the recall list, I'm advocating for that be a communication that we should be able to use those products. So, again, there's visual examples on here and explanation of my stance on that.
Okay.
I would like, can I comment on the non-swaddle part of it?
Okay.
I understand the pull of the Group 3 license. Definitely we need to continue to work on that. I will say that overall, I don't know what feedback has come into here. Overall, the need for different ratioing is critically important. The thought process that the C2 to C3 being cost prohibitive and not an effective, viable business is 100% spot on. What was missing for myself and others, and it is spelled out in my testimony, is that definition of how many total under school age, so that it would be in a format that we are used to and can follow easily, and then how many preschoolers we can have. So that would be my comment on that. But it was definitely my little small world. I had many providers saying, yes, that's exactly what we need, in particular at that level. There's always providers that have other more infants in ratio or other things as suggestion, but this one definitely does the viable business.
Yes. And thanks, Ms. Cunningham. I'm glad that you brought that up because it does warrant a discussion.
Yes.
And I know that Representative Peterson and I will continue to work on this issue throughout this year and into the interim because it is important. Whether or not we even have another classification of a license for childcare deserts, perhaps. But it certainly is a continue that conversation, and we want to make sure it's right. So thank you for bringing that on to the record.
On the insurance, I don't have a comment in general because I'm not in that situation, but on the end of the bill with the clear language and the communication between the counties and DHS and including providers is critically needed. Providers sit without information. There's disagreement or lag time between the county and DHS and then how it actually gets to providers. Providers sit closed down or with condemnation for months. And it's just because of timing and miscommunication or lack of communication. So anything that would improve that aspect of it would be well supported.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, next up we've got Stacy Stout from the Minnesota Chamber. Come on up, Stacy. Please state your name for the record.
Ms. Stacy Stout with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 3403. The Minnesota Chamber represents over 2,300 business members across the state, mostly small and medium-sized businesses, and the number one concern we hear from our members is a workforce shortage. The current need for workers is compounded by the child care shortage in our communities. The acute shortage of affordable quality child care facilities, particularly in Greater Minnesota, impacts employment opportunities for those families with young children and increases the worker shortage for our employers. When a potential employee can't find child care, they can't fill a job opening. And this growing problem has the potential to impede economic success in every community across our state. Therefore, we support this legislation as one way to encourage an increase in child care providers in communities. To keep our workforce challenges from hampering economic growth, we must encourage the growth of high-quality child care providers. So we hope you will support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. All right, next up we have Julie Seidel. Welcome back, Julie.
Good morning. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Julie Seidel, and I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Association of Child Care Professionals. I've also been a licensed child care provider for 15 years in Anoka County. Thank you for taking the time today to hear my testimony in regards to House File 3403. This bill currently has three components to it, including elimination of the annual insurance notification, and I'd like to focus most of my testimony on that today. Family child care providers have consistently called for a reduction in required paperwork as one of the means to relieve the increasing burdensome licensure. The amount of paperwork we must complete increases almost every year, and last session was no different. Instead of seeing a streamlining and reduction in paperwork requirements as recommended by the Bipartisan Task Force on Child Care Affordability and Accessibility, we ended the session with more. MACCP proposed language this session to reduce some of the unnecessary paperwork that does not impact the health and safety of children in care, and eliminating the annual insurance notification was one of those pieces. We're incredibly grateful when we saw Representative Peterson include that in her bill. In 2013, when this requirement was first implemented, the legislative intent was to ensure parents receive accurate information as to whether or not their child care provider carried liability insurance. The end result was a new paperwork requirement that included initial notification at the time of enrollment. So when a parent enrolls in their child in their program, I must tell them that at that time whether or not I carry liability insurance. And then repeat notices every year that must be signed by all parents or guardians at the time a policy is renewed, changed, expires on an annual signed reminder that the provider still does not have liability insurance. Unless there is a change in insurance status, the subsequent notice each year is redundant, unnecessary, and does not improve accuracy of reporting. For most of us, that is 6 to 8 pieces of paper that must be filled out and stored. It also means tracking down 6 to 8 parents for signatures on the form. For me, it means 9 families. MACCP supports the initial notification at the time of enrollment, and remember, this already exceeds what most businesses are required to provide, and then a subsequent notice only if the insurance status changes. This bill would eliminate the annual notification for any policy that renews automatically. As long as there is no interruption in coverage, the insurance status has not changed, and no additional notification should be required. We encourage you to support this portion of the bill. The last portion deals with investigations, and MACCP supports this piece as well. During an investigation, the county agency that actually supervises the provider and conducts the investigation makes a recommendation on any action they believe should be taken, and the Department of Human Services gets to determine whether or not they accept that. This bill would not change that. DHS would retain that power. They would simply be required to explain why they deviated from the county's recommendation if they do. This should be expected. We encourage you to support this portion of the bill as well. The first first portion of this bill is health and safety related and has already faced some opposition from individuals and organizations concerned about safety. We do appreciate the addition of the photographs on DHS's website. We think that's very helpful. Where I have been seeing the problem with the infant sleep sacks is, like has been stated, between licensors, they're not understanding. We've had child care providers that have gone to classes, and the trainer has held up a certain brand of sleep sack, not for the brand but for the style of sleep sack. And the provider has gone out and went on Facebook and said, we can only use this brand of sleep sack. So the addition of those pictures on the website would be a definite clarification. If your licensor said it's not okay, you can take them right to the website and say, well, this is the sleep sack that is approved by DHS. So that would be a huge clarification. But I do agree with removing the hood portion. Hoods cannot be on those infant sleepers at any point in time. Because of that, because it's already had some opposition, we would ask that, if possible, to remove that portion from this bill, and that way we could separate it so each of these bills could stand on the merit of their own and can be debated without preventing the non-health and safety-related pieces in this bill from passing. And we are happy to work with the author and the committee members on proposed language to address some of those concerns as well. Again, I'd like to thank Representative Peterson and the committee for continuing to look for solutions to this child care crisis.
All right. Thanks, Julie. Appreciate it. All right. So is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to come forward?
Oh, boy.
Good morning. If you want to state your name for the record.
Yes. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Brittany Browning, and I am the director and lead pre-K teacher at Child's Planet in Mankato. It's been a long road getting here. I'm here to testify on this bill because I feel that we need more transparency. And I support the idea that we should be getting information in a timely manner. There is communication between the commissioner and the DHS licensors, but there is nothing with us. In September 2015, we had a licensing review. Since visits are unannounced, I wasn't able to assist the licensor when she visited. She remained at the facility for 5 to 6 hours. When her visit was done, no discussion was made with me to inform me that there was serious and chronic issues. When we didn't hear from our licensor in the normal time frame of 2 to 3 weeks, we reached out to her. She informed us at that time she is still working on our correction order. November, December, and January came and went with no word. In February of 2016, she called the facility to get information on a sleep directive and a correction order. I inquired again at this time about her missing correction order and told she was still working on it. On April 25th, 2016, we got notice that based on the number and serious nature of licensing violations, on September 29, 2015, the commissioner is placing Child's Planet on a conditional license for 2 years. She found 33 citations, stating 19 of them were repeat. If we wanted to dispute it, we had 10 days. We attained a lawyer and dispute it, and DHS did not take any of them away. We were given 6 additional terms to follow on top of the rules. Those terms were to write what I call my letter of shame, stating we have a conditional license, and put in there how long it was for. 15 days we had to get this letter written, sent to DHS for approval, and back up to the parents. We also had to amend our risk reduction plan. We had asked our licensor several times for help and got none. She just said it was a difficult document to understand. Our third term, on an ongoing basis during the conditional license, maintain a list of newly hired employees and document criteria on that form. Within 45 days, ensure staff have completed training in child development, CPR, first aid, SUIDS, and AHT. On a monthly basis, while on conditional license, we must complete staffing patterns. And our final term was to complete a daily maintenance, cleanliness, and hazard check. Naturally, we went through our citations, fixed all of them, and started meeting our terms. We started with the first term that had 15 days to make sure we got that done. Then we went for the one that had 30 days and then the 45 and started picking off the monthly basis ones. However, our licensor showed up on day 20. We only had three of those terms met. I was written up again for noncompliance. We then asked her for help to look at our hazard and maintenance log because I didn't understand the terms because it was not in plain language. It was open to interpretation. I asked her to look at our log. She refused. I asked her again. She said as long as it meets the terms and has the cleanliness, it would be fine. I pleaded with her to please look at it to make sure it was to her liking. She finally looked at it and said this would not be approved. I asked her to tell me what to change. I made those changes with her. Only then to be told 2 weeks later that it was still not approved. Same thing happened with our staffing patterns. It said on a monthly basis. If I would have done what the term said, I would have done it once a month if I wouldn't have asked her. But once I asked her, she said I had to do it with any staff change. And I have 6 binders where we're doing daily, hourly checks. So here I am, present day. My conditional license is set to expire on the 22nd of July of this year. I arrive every day to the center by 2:30 in the morning because I am afraid that I won't be in compliance again or I'm going to have a write-up because I had dirt or my cleaning company left a plunger. I wasn't told what would happen if I did have non-compliance. Do I get more sanctions? Do I get just written up? Do I get a temporary immediate suspension? Nothing was told to me of what to expect after. The torment and embarrassment I've endured these last 3 to 5 years has been unimaginable. I sleep an average of 2 to 3 hours a night. I lost being a trainer with a national company because of this ordeal. I have county licensors bad-mouthing me to other providers saying I am incompetent. All because I could not supervise my licensor when she visited to make sure she got what she needed. We deserve to have licensors that want to work with us, not against us. While I appreciate the timeline between the commissioner and the agencies, I think and I suggest that we get involved in that time frame. It took them 7 months to let me know I was on a conditional license. If I was that much of a danger, and if I had that serious of violations, why did it take 7 months? I need change. My staff needs change. And most importantly, my families and my kids. Thank you.
Thank you, Brittany, for coming. Thank you for sharing. Next up, we have a licensor to follow that up.
Hi. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kim Leopold. I am from the Association of Minnesota Family Child Care Licensors. We represent the entire state of Minnesota licensing workers. I came to respond to 3403, but as I was chatting a little bit with Ms. Seidel up there, some of the concerns that we as a group had have been removed or changed or altered, and we are in support of those changes. Because we do work with the entire state, the capacity one was an interesting one because some were in support of it. But again, we would want more clarification of the numbers under school age. You know, and I just pictured 17 people, two adults, four of which aren't mobile, trying to get all of them out of a house in a fire, things like that. So we are in support of rewording the language, however, that needs to be done. And in regards to the swaddling device as well, the main concern with that would be obviously the word blanket, because nothing can be in a crib. I have gone to a provider's, three actually, after there has been a death based on something in the crib or improper sleep space, and it's not easy for anyone. It's a crime scene. It becomes terrifying for everyone involved, mostly the children that are enrolled in the program, and I think anything we can do to continue to reduce the number of deaths in child care, we need to keep doing. We do not have any opposition to the part about the liability insurance. Less paperwork for them means less paperwork for us, so that's okay with us as well. And then the part in regards to the part about investigations, we don't have any opposition about that as well, and we would just ask that as well as informing the applicants or the providers that you also that DHS would also have to inform the licensing workers of the reasons from differing from our recommendations.
Okay.
I think that's all for now.
All right. Thank you for the suggestions. Appreciate it. All right. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify? No? All right. Members, is there any discussion? Yes, Representative Flanagan.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. I appreciate the amendment specifically on the ratio. I think there's a larger conversation that is needed here, and this is grounded in child development and safety, so thank you for that. I also just wanted to speak to, and I don't think you need to come up, Ms. Stout, but I did want to just mention that I think this is an important conversation for the chamber to be a part of, and I am grateful for your testimony. I think that there are opportunities for us to talk more about additional options, policy changes, where we can partner. So I appreciate because I think that the business community needs to be our partner in childcare. And that's all I have to say. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other member discussions to take place? No? All right. Representative Peterson, any final comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, and Representative Flanagan for your comments. I think that some of the testimony we've heard today talks about a little more of the issue that we've been dealing with. We know in 2013, when we had some problems, and we've come a long way since that time, and I think that this is sort of a readjustment from the massive overhaul and changes that we brought to our child care industry. And I am more than happy to work with all stakeholders to make sure that this bill is something that's workable for kids, because this is really what it's all about. It's about the kids. So with that, Madam Chair, I ask for your support.
All right. Thank you, Representative Peterson. Representative Peterson renews her motion that House File 3403 be approved and recommended to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. All right. The motion prevails, and House File 3403 is approved and recommended to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. Next on the bill is on the agenda is House File 3629. Is Representative Moran all right? Sorry. Oh, yep. 3246. Sorry. I forgot that we had moved. that other bill first. Okay. Well, Representative Moran moves House File 3246 be approved and recommended to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. Representative Moran, if you want to give a brief description to your bill.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Trauma-informed policies and practice is to create a resilient, trauma-informed society where all individuals and families have the opportunity and the support necessary to thrive. The goal is to advocate for public policies and programs at the state, local, and tribal levels that incorporate up-to-date scientific findings regarding the relationship between trauma around the lifespan and many social and health problems. In addition, work in collaboration with communities, cities, states, and tribes to develop trauma-informed and prevention-focused policies and practices that reflect experiences in the field. The aim of creating a task force is to build a broad and effective coalition across sectors and systems. We recognize that sustainable change requires the participation of the people most affected by policies and services, as well as those responsible for the implementation and a commitment to include everyone's voice. We know that people are fundamentally resilient, and I would like to see us prioritize actions and policies that support and build on natural strengths. We also know that many children have had early traumatic experiences. These children come into our lives, our schools, and programs with a variety of developmental needs. Professionals must understand the specific needs of the children and families they are working with in order to effectively build in strategies and support to help deal with these traumatic experiences. Individuals having the capacity and knowledge to intervene with a trauma-informed lens to achieve trauma-informed practices makes a difference in a child's outcome in life. So the ability to create a just, equitable, and trauma-informed society will require development of broad-based systemic solutions and structural reform in addition to new partnership and funding mechanisms. I want to thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to bring this bill before this committee with the hope of creating a task force that will ultimately look at trauma-informed policies and practices and how to help our state be the best it can for children, families, and communities.
All right. Thank you, Representative Moran. And I understand you've got some testifiers.
I do.
All right. So we've got Emma of People Serving People. And if you want to state your name for the record, please.
Sure. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Emma Juan, and I am the Educational Services Manager for People Serving People. I am also the first trauma ombudsperson for our organization. People Serving People is Minnesota's largest and most comprehensive family-focused homeless shelter. Last night, 322 people sheltered with us, two-thirds of which were children with just an average age of 6 years old. In addition to providing shelter and meals, we also provide supportive services that help families stabilize. In 2016, we underwent an organizational change to embrace trauma-informed care in every aspect of our work and to become a trauma-informed organization. I am here to support House File 3246 and share our organization's initiative to become trauma-informed and why trauma-informed care is a necessary and important lens. Families come to us with multiple types of trauma in their background, such as food insecurity, housing instability, witnessing or experience violence or abuse, and the trauma of seeing your parents terrified as they worry about keeping their families safe. Experiencing multiple traumas such as these can lead to a child's developing brain becoming stuck in fight, flight, or freeze mode, which prevents them from accessing higher order thinking skills because they are always preparing for the unknown. When a brain is stuck in this mode, not much learning can take place. In our classrooms, we reflect a trauma-informed approach by creating an environment where children feel supported, understood, and accepted. By using a trauma-informed lens, we are asking, what happened to you, rather than what's wrong with you. We don't assume a child acts naughty because they want to push our buttons or seek attention. We understand that these behaviors are what the child has learned, the only way they know how to act, and it's our role as their teacher to help them replace those maladaptive coping strategies by teaching new behaviors. We recently had a child walk into the classroom who seemed very tired, and he was crying a lot because mom left, and he was unwilling to come very far into the room. The teacher approached the child and said, "I know you miss mom, and I know you're not sure about school today, but mom always comes back for you, and she loves you very much. Let's go draw her a picture together. We can give it to her at the end of the day, and we can tell her just how much you missed her today." They went off together to draw the picture. The child's emotions were validated. He felt understood by his teacher, and their relationship and their trust together was strengthened. In the traditional response, a teacher might approach the child and say, "You're here now. You're fine. Stop crying." With this response, the child might feel more alone and more upset. They might spend the rest of the morning crying, or they might act out. Through the trauma-informed approach, we begin to see better outcomes for children, stronger relationships with their teachers, and teachers who are better equipped to handle behavioral or emotional challenges in the classroom. And as the research by the National Scientific Council on the Developing Child details, children with even just one strong, positive relationship with an adult show an increased resilience in overcoming adversity. Our trauma-informed approach is applied in each facet of our work, to safety and security, to our organizational policies and procedures, and in our communication with guests and staff across the organization. We see it as pivotal to creating the greatest stability for children in our community. Our children and their families will move out of our shelter, but they will continue to interact with other systems, from healthcare to education to public safety. It is our hope that these systems will ask the question, "What happened?" and not, "What's wrong with you?" Thank you for your time. Please support this legislation.
Thank you, Emma.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. All right, next up we have Ryan from the Homeless Student Coordinator. Or he's a Homeless Student Coordinator at the Minnesota Public Schools.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ryan Strack, and I work for the Minneapolis Public Schools, and I serve as the manager of homeless and foster care student services. And part of the reason we support the task force laid out here is the fact that my job even exists and that we need to have it. Every day in Minneapolis Public Schools and across the state, thousands of students get on school buses, vans, and taxis from a shelter or a hotel or from the floor of their friend's house. We have students who come to school from a foster home after having been removed from their home the night before. We have students who come from a refugee camp and enter school for the very first time in their life. We have students who arrived to Minneapolis Public Schools in May, and we are their fifth school in the third different state just within the school year. Understanding what our students experience before they come to school and after they leave is imperative to shaping how we respond, as Emma talked about, in our classrooms and with our teachers. Doing this in a collaborative and cross-sector way is ideal because students interact with different adults from different systems. We know from research and, frankly, from firsthand experience that trauma impacts how we all function in our daily lives, and this is especially true for children and their educational outcomes. The adverse childhood experiences, ACE, or the ACEs studies as it's known, showed us that childhood trauma would have impacts later on in life as adults with both health and well-being outcomes. And one of the big takeaways is that the more adverse childhood experiences someone has, the more difficult it can be to engage in education. House File 3246 would bring together experts from cross-sector areas, all related, education, human services, mental health, to try to help and build a plan from a statewide perspective that can help us do more of what People Serving People has done, which we think would benefit our students. Thank you for the opportunity to share briefly, and I'd like to thank Representative Moran for bringing the bill forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Strack. Next up, we have Becky from the Minnesota Communities Caring for Children, as well as Michelle Fallon. Are you both here?
Good morning, Madam Chair. Yes, we're actually not from the same organization,
oh, you're not?
So Michelle,
oh, okay, never mind.
We'll take one turn at a time if that's okay. But that's right. Yes,
support.
We work in collaboration, certainly, and are on the same page with many things. And yeah, So good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Becky Dale, and I am the Chief Program Officer at Minnesota Communities Caring for Children. And one of the biggest things that we spend our time on, and I especially personally, is on sharing across the state the new science that Representative Moran spoke about, of understanding how the biology of stress functions and understanding the impact of adversity in childhood and what the Adverse Childhood Experiences study tells us. Throughout human history, when we learn new things, we apply them. That's what to creating greater health for our communities and our world. And I just want to share really briefly with you one example of this, which I think helps illuminate the importance of trauma-informed care policies and practices. So in the early 1800s, a physician named John Snow, not the John Snow that's public, known on TV these days, but a physician named John Snow was living in London at the time of a very serious cholera outbreak. And it's a story that's often told in public health circles because at the time people thought that you caught cholera, essentially it was in the air. You caught it, and it happened very quickly. People would go from feeling well to actually death very rapidly. And Dr. Snow started mapping where people were getting sick. And what he discovered by actually mapping that it, most of the cholera outbreak was centered around a particular water pump. So this is before we understood about germ theory, before we understood how disease is transmitted. But he discovered that everybody was getting sick around this water pump. So the first thing that he did is started telling people, and of course everybody else wanted to tell everybody else to stay away from that water pump, right? And then, before too long, somebody figured out how to take the handle off the water pump so nobody could get water from it. The opportunity that we face now is actually pretty similar to that. In the last 20 years, we've learned an enormous amount about how trauma and stress function in our biology, and about the impact of adversity early in childhood. You heard the Adverse Childhood Experiences study referenced, and it actually connects to so many of the problems that we face as a society now. Many of you may know this. Even if we're looking at the physical health, diabetes, adult onset diabetes, obesity, smoking cessation, drug and alcohol use, even poor worker performance, many of those problems that we look at now have a huge impact in early adversity. So for us, that's the water pump. When we know that that early adversity impacts all of these things, and when we understand how our biology functions, we can start telling everybody about that, and we can start trying to figure out how to take the handle off the water pump. At our organization, we train people around the state to share the information, to talk about the biology of stress, the impact of trauma on the brain, the Adverse Childhood Experiences study. So in communities all over the state, people are learning this information, and then in their own communities, with their own community wisdom, looking at, okay, in our community, what does this mean? How do we take the handle off the water pump? And so I want to share one brief example of that with you. In Bemidji, there's an organization called Peacemaker Resources that we work with a lot, and they have shared this information a lot throughout the Bemidji schools, and particularly being in kindergartens, and so in, you know, the upper end of early childhood. And teachers are learning about the biology of stress and trauma, and they're learning about what kinds of practices can we start doing in our classroom. One of the big things about the way our brain responds to trauma is we practice things that we think protect us, and they become automatic the more we practice them, right? So as young children, if they're in a dangerous environment, they may repeatedly do things of fight and flight, right? And that becomes automatic. So when they end up in the classroom in kindergarten, they feel under threat, they may quickly go to fight or flight and then get in trouble again, right? When the teachers know this and they say, okay, we're going to start practicing something different. As a whole school, we're going to practice taking a deep breath at the beginning of the day. Teachers are going to start noticing when their own stress levels are increased and have that practice of taking a deep breath, that practice of stopping and noticing what's going on and making an internal adjustment that helps calm our protective systems, our fight and flight responses. So in one kindergarten class, they practice frequently ringing a bell and taking a deep breath. And they do it throughout the day. They stop and pause. They adjust to what's happening. And the teachers are learning this, so the teachers are implementing it. And there was one particular child who was running from class quite often, and so much that it was hard to maintain the structure of the classroom. The child would dash out of the classroom, and the teachers were working with them. The examples that were shared early about how to respond to kids, they were doing that. And it's not easy. I mean, these kinds of new responses take practice for all of us and take time to implement. At any rate, the teacher said to the student, we really want you here, and we can't do this every day. It takes too much of effort, and if we can't find a way to have you stay in the classroom, we're going to have to move you to some other situation. And the child wanted to stay, but it was that automatic response. So, of course, soon enough, the child runs again. And the teacher, in this instance, grabs her bell, runs out of the classroom. The child starts down the stairs. The teacher rings the bell. The student freezes, takes a breath, turns around and walks back into the classroom. Wow. So the thing that they had been practicing served that purpose. So I'm here strongly in support of this because we need the state level systems to also be looking at how do we innovate our systems? How do we change our systems? Communities are doing it. Communities are coming together to do it. And if we have this multi-level approach, from at the community level, at the state level, at the systems policy level, what we can change is pretty amazing. We can make some really remarkable and amazing changes that can impact many, many of the issues facing our state. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Becky. Michelle? Sorry, I was under the impression that you two were presenting together.
No, we just hang together from time to time.
Gotcha. Okay.
We share passion. So I'm Michelle Fallon. I am on the board of the Minnesota Association for Children's Mental Health and co-chair of the advisory board for the Infant and Early Childhood division of that organization. And I'm also one of the supervisors for the Infant and Early Childhood Mental Health Consultation System that's being developed by DHS. And so I want to agree with everything that's been said. But I want to just give an example of a way to take this trauma-informed approach into child care around the state, which is significant since 70% of our children under six are cared for part or all of the day by someone other than their parent. Infant and Early Childhood Mental Health Consultation is primarily a preventative service, which focuses on building adult capacity to support infant and young children's social, emotional, behavioral health and development, and much of that is done through helping providers themselves and parents themselves become trauma-informed. So it's a collaboration between the consultant, the staff, and the parents in order to help the adults build new perspectives and skills and strategies that promote children's healthy development. Some of the benefits of, and there is a growing research body, it's now considered an evidence-based practice, that it increases early learning staff competence in addressing trauma, adversity, and early childhood and family mental health concerns. It has been shown to reduce staff turnover in child-serving agencies, which this committee is well aware is a very significant issue facing us. It decreases mental health symptoms in children. And one of the things that I think is I really want to point out is that there's a growing body of evidence to show that mental health consultation also reduces the educational disparities that are being experienced by children of color. There's a growing body of research, much of it done by Walter Gilliam at Yale University, that shows there's a huge disparity in the number of children of color who are actually being expelled from early childhood settings. And in Minnesota, if we go back to the adverse childhood experiences research, we know that when that work was done in Minnesota in 2011, 7% of white Minnesotans had experienced five or more adverse childhood experiences, which is considered the tipping point for the kinds of negative outcomes that we are concerned about, compared to almost 1 in 5 African-American Minnesotans and 1 in 4 American Indian Minnesotans. So, again, I think if we think about how can we take the systems we have and integrate best trauma-informed practices into what we have to support the providers, the child care providers, and the parents, that goes a long way towards achieving our goal. But that requires that we be trauma-informed. formed, and I think the proposal to develop a task force on this is essential. Do I have time to share a short story?
Sure.
Okay, and this is available in the back. I brought some copies. But this was, I've synthesized, this was a testimonial from a child care provider in Greater Minnesota responding to how her mental health consultant had been useful to her. She's a family home child care provider agreed to participate in the program, which is voluntary, in large part because of her concerns about several children in her care who had experienced trauma. The provider reported that the concerning behaviors range from violent, and there are lots of quotes, I'll spare you the air quotes while I'm reading this, violent and uncontrollable to the eyes of the children showing sadness and staying away from others. Typical consequences for negative behavior were not working, and her concern was that other children could be hurt. The mental health consultant began visiting weekly over a period of months. The provider reported that she gained many new strengths from the consultant's teaching, suggestions, and lessons regarding children and mental health. Rather than diagnosing children, the consultant offered tips on calming our bodies and sharing our feelings, much like what Becky just described. And the provider reported that the consultant has made it much easier for her to approach families regarding their children's mental health and behavior. The consultant offered to speak to family members, offering assistance and providing information and resources to families that requested. The provider reported that her child care is now a healthier place because of her work with the mental health consultant and that there have been so many improvements with the children in my daycare. So thank you for listening, and I hope you'll feel free to grab a little brochure at the end. And thank you very much, Representative Marina.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Karina Perkins from Wayside Recovery Center. And then following, we have Jackie Thomas.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Karina Forrest Perkins. I am the CEO for Wayside Recovery Center and also a subject matter expert for the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration on the areas of developmental trauma, historical trauma, and adverse childhood experiences. And that intersection point between treatment and prevention and what we're looking at now with significant issues in with our families with regard to the education that with addiction that we're dealing with societally. So we've had a lot of excellent points made. I will be brief. I'm coming from a provider lens and also from a policy lens of working nationally as a consultant and also looking at multiple states and communities trying to find the high leverage point, the ability to make a difference in their systems and in their structures. And as Representative Moran mentioned, this particular House file, this task force would assist us in bringing a cross-sector representation together and talk about where those leverage points are, begin to look at how we grant dollars to providers, what types of metrics that we hold people accountable to and for, and where we can begin to look for that critical data. So often we make the mistake of not trying new things or innovating because we're looking for that model, that evidence-based practice. And I can tell you that this is relatively new science. When I started in the field, there were less than 400 peer-reviewed articles on neuroscience and brain development and the impact of the accumulation of stress on the developing brain. Just last year, there were under 40,000 peer-reviewed research articles on this topic. For us to ignore that significant research finding would be obviously a missed opportunity, but it would also be a bit of, I think, a lack of leadership on our part as state stakeholders. So when we try to think about how to hold ourselves accountable and look for where our data can improve, Minnesota needs to be a leader there, and I think that this is the beginning of where that can take place. So just to close, we have the scientific evidence that supports the establishment of this task force and the amplification of this issue in Minnesota so that we can lead other states and communities around the United States and contribute to policy and practice change that prioritizes the development of children, the healing that takes place in the relationship between children and families, and stops us from waiting to intervene only after someone is ill or injured. So thank you very much, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you. And then is Jackie Thomas in the? Hi. You're up, and then we'll move to questions.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and all. Thank you for taking the time to hear me.
If you want to state your name for the record, ma'am.
Yes.
Thank you.
My name is Jacqueline Thomas, and I am first and foremost always a parent. But I am also a Ramsey County Citizen Review Panel member. I am an alum of Parent Leadership for Child Safety and Permanency with Minnesota Communities Caring for Children. And I'm also the president of a PTA community chapter, The Village, in St. Paul. This house file really digs deep and holds deep for me. Well, first and foremost, addressing early childhood trauma will definitely require a shift in policy and practices in Minnesota. Early childhood trauma occurs when a child from age birth to 5 or 6 experiences or witnesses a painful and harmful incident, which can include separation from parent, high level of stress association with living in poverty, circumstances, and surroundings. And I say that because most people automatically think when you say living in poverty, it's just simply about not having enough money, not income. And it's not necessarily that. It's the surroundings you live in. It's the conditions that you're forced, because you don't have funding and economics to live in anything different. And including child abuse and neglect. According to the National Center for Children in poverty, trauma has been shown to negatively impact early brain development, cognitive development, learning, social-emotional development, the ability to develop secure attachment to others, and physical health. When our brains are not given the opportunity to develop properly, we end up with adults and parents and caregivers with mental health issues, diagnoses, and challenges that are caring for the children birth to 5 or 6. These are also the adults that Dr. Rob Anda would identify as adverse childhood experiences, known as ACEs. Trauma-informed policy and practices would also are long overdue and would also help our education system. It would look at allocating dollars to areas that would assist our families with the proper resources, help residents take back their communities. It could also lead to mental health cost reduction. I would also like to add, symptoms resulting from trauma could directly impact a student's ability to learn. Students might be distracted by intrusive thoughts about the event that prevent them from paying attention in class, studying, or doing well on a test. Exposure to violence can lead to decreased IQ and reading ability. Some students might avoid going to school altogether. Exposure to violence and other traumatic events can disrupt youth's ability to relate to others and to successfully manage emotions in the classroom setting. This can lead to poor behavior, which can result in reduced instructional time, suspensions, and expulsions. Long-term results of exposure to violence include lower grade point average and reduced graduation rates, along with increased incidence in teen pregnancy, joblessness, and poverty. As I said earlier, it really, really touches home for me. I grew up in a home with domestic violence and could not, in classroom, pay attention, because what was always going through my head was, are we going to be running down the street again? This is long overdue. We need to pay attention to the children that are already, so we can stop the mental health so we can stop our children from being suffering and going through these challenges, because we can do something about it. This is the children going downstream, and how can we affect the children stop going downstream? You have it in your hands to be the point of helping to stop the children from going downstream. Thank you for hearing me today.
Thank you, Ms. Thomas. Mm-hmm. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? All right. Seeing none, we'll move to member questions. Representative Grisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Moran. I told you I was going to have a couple questions, and let me preface it this way. Everything that I heard was spot on. And what I think is trying to be accomplished in this bill is large and is very comprehensive. And so the way I want to position these questions, if you want to respond, that's fine. I would like to look at it this way. I mean, this is a committee process. This is an early committee. And I have a whole series of questions that are actually aimed at making this more successful, because I think what you're trying to do is so important, but I think that we're trying to do it in too broad a term. So let me just run through these, and maybe the best way is just to take some notes and have those prepared, because I know this would go to HHS reform, which we would be on as well. So, and I apologize, I've been taking a lot of notes because this is so important. I mean, everyone that testified, I mean, this is spot on. So saying that, please know that Inside is a really nice guy. So first of all, the committee and being trauma-informed is super important. I look at your timeline, and I don't know that it's realistic. I've been on task force. This would be an enactment. The possible earliest date would be May 1st. If you were to get through all the committees, get this to the House and signed by the governor, that leaves 7 months and 15 days to put a report out, which is January 15th. And I fear that's too soon for something this comprehensive. I don't know that you can get a report back to the legislature in time that it deals with all this. So that would be my first one, is I would recommend looking at that date. The other thing that concerns me, at least in the bill the way it's written, is my count, you have 16 members on the task force with a couple open question marks. On lines 1.1, we have the Commissioner of Human Services and designees. So is that one? Is that two? Is that five? It's just trying to get our arms around that number. And then these types of open-ended ones always bother me, and that is lines 2.3, representatives of any other group that they deem appropriate. To me, that's too open-ended. I mean, I think we can end up with too many people trying to vie for a position on this, and you could have a group that's right now possibly 16 as high as 25. And so now you're trying to get 25 disparate ideas and viewpoints together to get a report done in 7 months and 15 days. Okay, so there's that. By the way, I hope you know I spent a lot of time with this bill because I think it's super important, so I went through it. Another thing that I would look at is you have on line one, or the bill has on line 1.13, two members representing county social services. Which counties? And the reason I bring that up is because I don't see a representation of metro and rural. I don't see a regional representation, and I think that's important because there are certainly some very different things that happen in densely populated areas versus those of us in the rural. I mean, I don't pretend to understand all the densely populated things. And likewise, there's things that are faced up in the far reaches of the state that are different, that also constitute trauma, and that we have to take those into account. So that would be another one that I would put together and look at. Another thing, when we look at, and I believe it was Karina, was, yes. And I don't know if I should, you said you're an expert. Did you have an official title behind you, like PhD or anything? That's fine. Just subject matter. I just want to make sure I get the title right. You talked about the disparities and how they break down. And when I look back at some of the research that I've read and that compares to that and actually coincides, in 2016, the National Survey of Children's Health combined with the U.S. Census says that there are disparities, and we all know that, between the ACEs and that the non-white or the African-American population is the highest, hovering around the 61% or so, and then followed closely by the Hispanic non-white, the 51%, white non-Hispanic 40%, and Asian below at the 23%, and then we have, we can break that into the Native American. The reason I bring this up is because the representation on this actually puts three people from the Native American, one from the Indian Affairs Council, and two from Tribal Social Services. So we have a higher representation of Native Americans in councils, even though they represent the second or possibly third tier. So I would think we'd want to look at that and make the representation fit the ACEs disparity levels.
Can I respond to that? I was the one who brought that up. I was quoting Minnesota data.
And that's fine. I'm happy to hear it. I'll get through my questions and then however you want to do it, Madam Chair. And again, I'm not, I don't want to sound like I'm attacking the research. I just want to make this a really, really tight and good task force. I'm taking a pause, so who's ever taking notes can keep up. The next adversity level that we talk a lot about, and I want to bring this up and just ask a question, is when we get into the person or the three licensed healthcare professionals that are dealing with neurobiology, line 1.19 to 1.2, is that encompassing chronic addiction, chronic inebriation, opioid abuse, and drug abuse? Is that we're trying to capture that? And the reason I bring that up, because one of the largest factors of ACEs, as I've researched this, is divorce, separation, and economic adversity. So one of the things that I have found out in ACEs is we have these super high issues that everyone wants to talk about, which are important, whether it's opioid abuse, violence, and all that. But if we forget the largest long-term toxic stress can be family problems, can be stress, can be divorce. And so I don't want to take all of our focus and put it on the lowest statistical ones and forget the highest statistical ones that these kids are coming to school with every day. And so that's why I ask that is, you know, is there, should there be a family counselor, marriage expert, somebody that can talk about this? Because as I understand this task force, it's to put a report out on trauma to inform us so that it guides our policy. And I would hate that report to come back statistically representing areas that are maybe not as high, like I said. I mean, to come back and just say that ACEs is only going to be on domestic violence, abuse, and all these, and forget this larger one in our policy, we would leave a lot of kids behind. And then, I think we have to talk about, and I look in here, in the representation, there is no representation on the refugees, the refugee population, no matter who that could be. And I think that I want to open this up as well. In greater Minnesota, I'll speak to my area, when I hear refugee or when people talk about refugee, they like to talk about the Somalian population. And they point to that. However, I remind them, your refugee population is the hurricane victims from Katrina. It's the people that, it's any family that's being dislocated because of some horrible event where they are, and that's creating trauma for these kids. I mean, you take kids that were uprooted by the hurricanes a couple years ago and drop those into central Minnesota where the weather's going to get cold and they have no food, shelter, and all that. You talk about trauma. So, I mean, there's so much here, and I think what you're trying to get to is the fact is those children with these toxic levels of stress are going to arrive in a school district and a teacher has to figure out in a relatively short period of time what's making that kid tick and why they're having the troubles they have. The last one, and this is just the English teacher me coming out, on lines, well, when we get into lines 2.8 to lines 2.13, we're trying to, what I see happening here is we're trying to define, or the bill is trying to define, this is what this task force will do. I read these lines and it seems to be a bit incongruent with all the testimony I heard, and it sounds like we have all this about trauma, but we're going to try to accomplish this, and that this is very important. So in lines 2.12 to 2.13,
We say identify social detriments of health and well-being of all families and recommend solutions to eliminate racial and ethnic disparities in the state. I think we should probably, and maybe this is for the reviser, I think we should probably move to eliminate racial and ethnic disparities in the state closer to the subject to actually define what we're, what disparities we're removing. Are we just removing disparities across the board? Are we removing disparities among ACEs levels? Are we, you know, so just to be very, very clear, because again, you're giving this task force less than 8 months to accomplish a yeoman's task. Madam Chair, those are my questions.
Very insightful, Representative Kreisha. When I saw your name on the list, I said, well, we're going to have to wait till the end.
I'm sorry.
He's going to do some talking, so thank you. Did we have, oh, yes, Representative Albright.
Get out your paper. Representative Moran, thank you for bringing this. As Representative Kreisha said, this is, I think, a really, really important and integral part of the overall child care program that is lacking. I'm coming up from a kind of the Joe Friday perspective, and so as Representative Kreisha said, these are all in support of your legislation as opposed to being derogatory. I note in one of the handouts from the Center for the Study of Social Policy, that they did a 2-year study. And I think, for me personally, and I think for the members on the committee, I think we would greatly benefit from having a copy of that provided to all the members. I think this committee is really charged with developing a baseline of knowledge that we can build upon. And with the testimony from the folks in support of the bill, I take no disagreement other than saying I just want more. I want to understand this even more. And so the depth and the wealth of information and studies that can be provided to us, I think just informs us. But it also, as Representative Kreisha really demonstrated, it gives us pause to say, how do we make it better, and how do we engage people at the level where it is most meaningful? And so... If that 2-year study is available as soon as possible, I would greatly appreciate having a copy for myself. I also note then a MDH study that was completed in 2011, and is that one prior to, I think, one that you noted in 2014 or 2015? And I might have my dates incorrect. But, again, the same request is made for, I think, the committee as well as for me personally to have a copy of that survey done. Just, again, for the 2011 MDH study on ACEs.
Representative Moran.
That's the question.
I think that again, just fills in the baseline and acts as a foundational document. And I thought the testimony by Ms. Dale was very informative in terms of we got to figure out how to take that handle off of the pump. I really appreciated that analogy. Thank you for that, Ms. Dale. So to your bill, a couple things, and I'm going to try not to duplicate what Representative Kreisha mentioned, but a couple thoughts on the representation on the committee itself. Oftentimes we hear notations about the juvenile justice system. And I understand about the confidentiality in that, but I think that may not be the root, because that is the outcome of a much deeper and earlier intervention. And so I'm wondering if the inclusion of both criminal and civil law officials for the parents to understand where they're coming from. Because unfortunately, when divorce and when the criminal system gets involved in the lives of the parents, the tragedy is that the kids are the ones that are affected. And so bring those two groups into the conversation. I'm sure that you thought of them, but I'm just reiterating that I think those would be so important to add to the overall robust nature of what you're hoping to accomplish here. I, too, was looking at the section on the back, as Representative Kreisha did, in terms of, I think that you've got a duality of purpose, whether it be, you know, lines 2.8 through 2.10 or 2.12 through 2.13. And so I wrote in terms of, I have a star, and the question is, like, which one? Which one do you really want to go after? Because I think they are separate and distinct. Maybe there's two reports that comes out of this study group. Because I think they focus on different elements that try to approach and attack the same problem. And so maybe that's just a helpful critique. And lastly, you know, we talk in this committee a lot about child care, but I think Representative Kreisha has also talked eloquently and with passion about foster care. And I think that should be included in this task force as well, because that is where most of these kids start feeling these, I'm sorry for the trauma of life. And so I would just encourage you to include those two in some substantive fashion. And then lastly, with regard to the expiration of your task force, I think, as Representative Kreisha suggested, I think the timeline for the first report is, I think it would do an injustice to the people that are speaking and wanting to be involved in this because of their passion and because of the significance of the report. So I would urge you to, you know, extend that out to give them sufficient time to do a job well. But here's where I would add to what Representative Kreisha said is, why would you want to sunset this? If the work is so important, why wouldn't you want that first report to be a baseline to establish what's going on, kind of almost a triage, and then make recommendations, and then avail yourself of those same people to work together on an ongoing basis to come back and say, what are we doing? What is working? What is not working? And how do we make improvements based upon what we discovered in our first report? So I applaud you for your work. I applaud you for your passion. And I hope that we've been helpful to you as you move forward. And I look forward to hearing it again in Health and Human Services.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Representative Flanagan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Moran, thank you so much for bringing this bill forward. And this kind of conversation that we just had with Representative Kreisha and Representative Albright, these are the conversations that I think we need to be having as it relates to our littlest Minnesotans. And I think that these are the conversations that Minnesotans want us to be having in a bipartisan way. I share some of the concerns, but also I think it's an opportunity to have a committee that is or a task force that is reflective of the state of Minnesota as a whole. So taking a look at that, I think, is important. And as Representative Kreisha mentioned, having additional folks from the refugee community, the Somali community, while, you know, I have to say that having an overrepresentation maybe of American Indian people is not anything that I have a problem with. I think that there's one of the concerns that I would have is just making sure that the urban Indian community is also represented, as some of our challenges may look a little bit different than folks who are in reservation communities. I, too, would encourage you to give yourself a little more flexibility with this end date of January 5th, 2019. I think this particular task force is pretty revolutionary in that we are not doing enough work around trauma-informed care. Minnesota is a leader in many ways, and I think we can be the leader here in giving ourselves additional time, one, to even just be able to assemble this task force and make sure that it the right folks are at the table, I think matters. And also just I don't know if that end date really does justice to the kind of conversations that we need to be having and the depth of those conversations as well. The other thing that I just want to point out, I think it's important that we, and as we're talking about racial disparities and ethnic disparities. And my hope is that we are doing more work looking through that equity lens. But that we talk about recommend solutions in line 2.13, recommend solutions to eliminate racial and ethnic disparities in the state. My question is that as related to adverse childhood experiences, or are we looking to recommend those policies broadly? I hope that that's what we do in this body overall moving forward, but I just want, there may be a need for some clarification there as well. And I would also like to see that report from the 2011 survey of from the Department of Health. I think that that's would be a foundational document for all of us to have. The last thing that I would just say is in particular to Ms. Thomas for your testimony and to say thank you. It is it's important that we feel as though we have spaces where we can share those stories. I'm a child witness and a survivor, and I know that fear and that feeling, and sometimes it pops up when I least expect it. The courage that you have in talking about those experiences, and the dedication that you have to ensuring that fewer young people have to experience that trauma as well is commendable. And finally, to Representative Moran, I know that this is the work that you do every day, and I can't think of a better person to bring this bill forward, and I am grateful for the work that you do at the Capitol, but also the work that you do in the community, and I think this is a reflection of that. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Flanagan. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as obviously from previous questions, this is a very broad, diverse topic. This and other task forces, one of the biggest problems I see in HHS is that across the state we've got a patchwork of different government and private entities. And you look, there's overlap here, there are gaps there. When you look at, and the reports come out and you analyze, it'd be nice to understand a little bit about how that patchwork would affect the implementation, the coverage, the disparities, because I think the better we can understand what we have out there and how to utilize it more efficiently, effectively, will help with the results. And it's not specific just to this group, but I look across, you know, the north side. They've got a lot, they've got people that all they do is look at what is out there and advise and help people to be able to take advantage of their individual needs. And I sort of think that would be in the back of the mind as you know, the task force moves along, seeing what's there, and that it's going to be different even across the metro and the state. So, you know, building off on the questions that, you know, the former, you know, the other reps have brought in it. I just think delivery and how we do it with our, you know, maze of entities would be another component. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Quam. Do we have any other member comments or questions? Okay. Well, any final comments, Representative Moran?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. So first, again, thank you for bringing this bill to this committee. Representative Preshaw, I would like to have your notes. I couldn't keep up with you. So let's talk offline more about this. And I take heed to what you're saying. The governor responded to a crisis and created the Task Force on Child Protection. There was a task force that was created. And I believe that task force, I mean, it was a huge job, right? From that came 93 recommendations. And I think that task force was sunsetted, but it created the legislative task force that we now are both on. So I take every comment that you stated, realizing that you know this and what is ahead of us. in trying to create a process that's going to create some better outcomes and where we begin to look at solutions through a trauma-informed lens. And I would definitely like to continue to work with you on all your suggestions. I think they're valid suggestions. And I do agree that, so let me just give you some backgrounds on this bill, in this task force, which is something that I thought about. I introduced a bill a couple of years ago on this. And this bill was actually written by some staff from Minneapolis, right? And I took it on because I thought it was a great bill, definitely something I believe that we need to begin to look at the state level. And as I looked at it, I was like, oh, we can do some more here. We can change some things here. But my thought was we can also do some amendments later if possible. So that was my thought process. I do think we need to have a more diverse representation from different groups of individuals of communities as for the refugees and just more diversity in general. Bringing in housing advocates, I think, would also be another suggestion. And looking at the foster care piece is also hugely important. I really appreciate Representative Albright, your suggestions. And quite frankly, I'm really impressed that you guys really took some time to look at this and see some value in it and how important it was, because it really is important. So I really, really do appreciate that.
That's why your bill's before the committee. I
don't remember MDH. We do need that study. So whoever
does the study,
we will get that information to you and all the other studies to help you be a little bit more informed. If we look at some decision-making here, we'll get that to you as soon as possible. And so when you look at the duties of the task force, in my mind, they are interrelated. Because when you look at the systems, Department of Human Service, Education, Public Health, Juvenile Justice, Criminal Justice System, and when you look at within all of those systems, you get the racial and ethnic disparities within all those systems, within the African-American community, the Native American community, and communities of color. They are embedded within all of those systems. So bringing those systems together collectively to have a more trauma-informed lens of how we do our work and practice is important, in partnership with community, in partnership with professionals, in partnership with parents. All of that is important to do. So in my mind, they work hand-in-hand. They go together. Let's see here. And, you know, Representative Kwan, in looking at how we bring all the patchwork together, I say in good intentions, a lot of what we do here is patchwork work, right? And we got to find a better way to be in sync and bring the different systems together that are impacting people's lives and our kids' lives and our schools. We just have to do a better job at that. And I really believe creating a task force to look at how we do our work here through a trauma-informed lens can help us with that process and being more in sync with how we allocate dollars, how we create policies that create practices back in the community. I think this task force will help us do that. They would do that and help us be better at it. And that's the hope, that we can do that.
We got tax committee moving okay. in.
And so, again, thank you. Thank you for all the suggestions. I look forward to working with all of you and Madam Chair as we move this to Health and Human Service. I look forward to bringing an amendment forward that makes this a little bit clearer.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Representative Moran renews her motion that House File 3246 be approved and recommended to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
And House File 3246 is approved and recommended to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. All right, members, that concludes our hearing. And to the providers in the room, I just want to let you know that we hear you here on our committee, and we thank you for bringing forward your stories, your experiences, and your passion. Our work is not done yet, even though our committee has wrapped up. I want to thank you for breaking the silence to end the child care crisis. And, you know, as I've heard the stories and the tears and saw the shaking on the testimony stand, you know, members, if this was corporate America, there would be something that could be done where you could take those grievances and be heard. And there would be repercussions for those employers that have treated you and mistreated you and made you afraid to come to work. And so I just want you to know that I validate that your feelings are validated, and we're going to do everything that we can to make your work more joyful again and to bring peace into your life and to make Minnesota a great place to open up a child care business and get our businesses back to being thriving and full of employers, and we're going to continue moving your issues forward. Our next meeting is suspended. In place of our regular subcommittee meeting, a meeting of the full Health and Human Services Reform Committee will take place on Wednesday the 21st in this room, room 200 at 8:15 a.m. It is sure to be exciting, so you don't want to miss out. Thank you.